Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
But that's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, editor-at-large of Recode. You may know me as Maggie Haberman's evil twin, and that's real evil. But in my spare time, I talk tech, and you're listening to Recode Decode from the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today, we're going to play an interview I conducted with A.G. Sulzberger, the publisher of The New York Times. We spoke as part of a fundraising gala for Columbia University's Knight Bajot Fellowship Program. A.G. has been publisher of The Times since January, but before that, he was a writer and associate editor at the paper. And I should disclose that, for those of you who don't know by now, I'm also a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. Now let's take a listen to my conversation with A.G., recorded in front of a live audience at the New York Marriott Marquis.
Please welcome A.G. Sulzberger and Kara Swisher.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, Arthur. A.G., what am I supposed to call you?
I think A.G. is perfect, but
all right, okay.
What does it say about how this is about to go that everyone who stopped me today said, good luck up there?
Good luck. Okay, good. Okay, fantastic.
I heard Kara.
First of all, Jeff, congratulations for that award. When I saw it, I thought it was the award for drinking more beer than Kavanaugh. But, I mean, come on, stop. I was worried too. I honestly, and your mother's here. He brought out his mother before to like, I'm going to be nice because his mother's going to rush the stage. But this picture worried me right here. Here's me looking like a real gay Johnny Cash. And here's him looking like he tells dad jokes 24/7. So, and he's just a dad. Congratulations.
Everyone what? Needs a straight man.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah.
And you're really straight. It's true. It's true. You look like 103. So, all right. So, by the way, I have a contract with them. Full disclosure. I don't care.
I tried to go edgy with the charcoal suit.
It's nice. You look good.
Okay, yeah.
Fine. Whatever. So, let's start talking about stuff. So, you have been in the job how long?
Since January.
January. So, what grade would you give yourself? Let's do a Donald Trump question.
Oh, I don't know.
You're supposed to say A. A plus?
Is that how it works?
That's what Donald
I think
did.
Journalists are supposed to take their time and make
right.
sure
so what,
check their
how
facts.
Do you think you're doing so far?
We actually have two times tables right here.
Right.
I'm going to just shout out an answer that's nice but not too nice.
Right. They're going to say A to you. Come on.
Okay.
What do you, how do
All
you
right.
think you're doing? Tell us about the beginning of doing this.
Well, I think the report is looking great.
I think
the report is looking as strong as it's ever looked under Dean Baquet and Joe Kahn and this team here. A lot of people want to talk about, you know, just the political climate right now, but
yeah.
at the Times we're determined to cover, you know, the stories of this era, which is climate change, it's technology and how mm-hmm. it's disrupting every facet of how life is lived. And it's the rest of the world. And, you know, I'm really proud of the reporting that we're doing, you know, even as we're, you know, publishing a 14,000 mm-hmm. word investigation of the president's finances. We're also on the front lines in Yemen trying to demand that the world, that we, you know, that our readers pay attention to the rest of the world too. So, I mean, if we're just looking from the report standpoint, I'm extremely happy after this year.
Right. But I mean, the fact of the matter is it's Trump and also Trump, right? Correct. And that's been sort of the center of what you've all been covering because you've been set up as the opposite of. And like even today's news this week with the pipe bombs and everything being sent in the danger. You all are at the center of something much bigger than just, hey, we're going to do just nice reporting. Or do you not see it that way?
Well, I don't think we ever see our job as, hey, we're just going to do nice reporting.
Right. Things have changed. You don't feel like things have changed in the past 12 months?
In the past 12 months specifically, look, I think we live in consequential times, and I think it's impossible to miss that. You know, I mean, we've seen the list of, you know, of just what's come up on this stage, you know, trade wars, the rise of populism, not just domestically, but all around the world, seemingly simultaneously, you know, from Poland and Hungary to Brazil and through our own country. You know, and we're seeing the, you know, the increasing signs of climate change. You know, we saw the UN report a couple of weeks ago. So I don't think it's the story is just Trump. In fact, I think in some ways, you know, Trump emerges out of a convergence of other stories around globalization and migration and, you know, and this global populism and income inequality. Mm-hmm. And I think our responsibility at the New York Times is to be covering the world broadly, because I think we start to make a mistake as a society when we start to just disentangle these threads and say that these things aren't connected. Now, as far as Trump, we've invested deeply in our Washington bureau. I think you've seen, you know, that we are committed to covering the administration and all the institutions of power in Washington as aggressively as anyone.
But he's also made the New York Times, made CNN, made other publications a character in this insane reality show that's going on. What is that like in terms of pressure on you? And you got sucked into it by speaking to him, apparently. Yeah. You went over to this meeting. Explain this meeting for the, you went.
Yeah, so.
I wouldn't have gone out without a body cam going there, but go ahead.
I had something better than a body cam. I had James Bennett, our editorial, our opinion editor.
All right.
And former White House correspondent. So the president reached out through the press secretary and asked for a meeting. I didn't know what it was about. I assumed he wanted to grumble. You may have noticed we've been doing some aggressive coverage of the administration. And I believe very strongly that it is the right of anyone who's in the news regularly to raise concerns about that coverage. Dean Baquet, our editor, has an ironclad rule, which I've always appreciated, that he won't meet the president off the record.
Okay.
He feels like presidents of the United States, you know, when they're meeting with the editor. So, but I do believe that you should be able to raise concerns. So I decided to go, studied up in all the various stories and investigative reporting we were, investigative threads we were pursuing that he might grumble about. My read of it was, I think he wanted to introduce himself and, you know, saw it largely as, you know, something of a social visit. Now, I don't know if he had some agenda behind that. You know, I'm young, I'm new to the job. Mm-hmm. Maybe he thought he could charm my socks off and I'd call off the hounds. But for me, I felt it was an opportunity to raise my concerns, you know, sitting across the table, looking him in the eye about his rhetoric, you know, which I told him directly and has subsequently been
made
public.
Yeah, that worked. Go ahead.
Well, it's,
no,
I mean, it's
not.
Funny to say that.
I know.
It's
not yours in particular, but.
Well, so I raised concerns saying that his rhetoric was not just divisive, which, you know, I think people had focused on, but it was getting really dangerous, and not just domestically, which again, we too often focus on, but was really making the conditions for reporters abroad, particularly in countries with limited press freedoms, much harder because, you know, the world's foremost staunchest defender of the free press and the free speech has always been this country, and people could smell that we were no longer fighting that fight. So I raised those concerns. I was not naive enough to think that he would, you know, look me in the eye and say, "Oh, thanks. I've had my eyes opened by this." But he made a show of listening politely and engaging with the conversation, asking questions. And then the next week proceeded to ratchet up his rhetoric, you know, back to level 15 where it had been, with the enemy of the people. But then did, you know, I think everyone who cares about journalists and journalism a favor by, you know, allowing me to put on the record that he was warned about this. He was warned that these words would, you know, potentially, maybe even perhaps inevitably have consequences. And I think, you know, you can argue about whether or not, you know, it was naive of me to go there, or whether you think that, you know, people in my role should be meeting with the president. We can have that argument. You've heard my view. But I do think it's really important that someone took that opportunity to raise this concern directly, because I don't want him
to
be able to
say. So where are we now on that? Because the day after everybody gets a pipe bomb, he says something right. He reads it off the prompter, whatever they handed and made him say. And the next day it was the same thing. Where we are in terms of danger? Because you see what happened in Saudi Arabia, those signals are everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, Saudi Arabia, what happened to, you know, our colleagues at Reuters and Myanmar, you know, a reporter was raped and murdered in Bulgaria, you know, Annapolis, you know, is, you know, in all of our minds. This is a scary time, and this is before I even talk about, you know, just the amount of hate and vitriol that people experience, and I imagine you've experienced just in the digital space.
So I dish it out, but go ahead. No.
So where is it? Mm-hmm. You know, this is a really troubling time for all of us who believe in the role of a free press in supporting a free society.
Are you scared for the New York Times? Are you scared when, I mean, are you just, or assuming it's...
Look, my job is to worry on behalf of my colleagues, and I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't trying to anticipate, you know, what risks I need to be thinking about. But the New York Times tries never to operate from a place of fear. You know, we've been operating around the world, on the ground, in dangerous environments, you know, for a long time, including, you know, full-time bureaus in Iraq and Afghanistan since the beginning of the wars there. And we know how to report when government minders are tracking us. We know how to report when our communications are being bugged. We know how to report when we're under threat. And I don't think we're there, but that's why I also don't feel particularly spooked at this point. What I'm more spooked about is the erosion of trust and the polarization of trust in media. I think that is an extremely worrying thing.
So that's something you've talked about, not wanting to be the resistance, not wanting to be the opposition.
Yeah.
The Times has gotten more opinionated, not just in opinions, but throughout. You have reporters on Twitter. You've got all kinds of things going on. There's much more throughout, especially digital media, much more attitude,
voice
in it. You have talked about that not being the case. And something I worry about is that if you don't have some sort of informed opinion that's from reporting, you end up typing words on a page, or not typing anymore, but you know what I mean? All it is just taking things down and being complicit in things that are something you shouldn't be in.
Yeah. Let me take that in a few different ways. I mean, one, I think, and you know, this is something that you've been a leader on as well. I think the old newspaper conventions don't work anymore. I think the indirection, you know, we did a lot of things as journalists, myself very much included, because I had a very traditional path through Metro dailies. But we did a lot of things that actually disguised why a reader should come to us and believe us. And we thought it was because we're not part of the story. We never want to make the story about us. But indirection, like, you know, that old convention of saying, like, Kara Swisher told a reporter today.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It didn't tell a reporter, you told me.
Right.
You know, I'm right here. Right. And that form is either confusing or feels misleading in the digital environment. And so I do think that we have systematically tried to strip some of, you know, those old, that's sort of like the newspaper ease out of our work, which has allowed more voice to come in. And I think in a really good way. I'm, you know, one of my colleagues, Neil Irwin, who's a Knight Badgett fellow, you know, is someone who, you know, I really admire how he can write with authority and expertise that bleeds through everything, but doesn't like spin over to opinion.
It's a really interesting, because when I was at the Wall Street Journal, there was when I worked there, there was a three words I hated: to be sure, comma, according to some sources, you know, blank. And I remember writing about Webvan, and they said, Kara, we need you to say, to be sure, some people feel Webvan is going to work.
Yeah.
And I said, to be sure, those people are idiots. Because based on my reporting. And so, you know, it was so pleasing to get out of that.
So I totally agree with you there. But I really do agree. Like, I think false equivalency is like the easiest, laziest form of protecting, you know, the appearance of independence.
Right.
When in fact you're actually, that's not what independence looks like.
Mm-hmm.
What independence looks like is following the truth wherever it leads and
right.
being comfortable with it leading someplace that you, A, you didn't anticipate, and B, you may not even want.
Sure, but coming to a conclusion, do you think that's what's going to happen? Because it happens digitally. On the online publications are much more. I mean, at Recode, we definitely say, yeah. guess what? Mark Zuckerberg ruined democracy, and here's why. Let me explain to you. Like, he moved fast, he broke things, and democracy was one of them.
Yeah. Well, so, we do have an opinion section, and thank you for joining it.
That's true. I know you agree with me on that. I'll get to that in a minute. Go ahead.
But look, I also think it's really important the role. So let me just, like, use one example that I think shows both sides of this. You know, we just did a 14,000-word, 18-month investigation, 3 reporters, yes. full-time, 2 badass editors, you know, a team project that painted the most comprehensive portrait of President Trump's finances that have been painted to date. And, you know, it wasn't full of, on one hand, on the other hand, we used the word fraud in one of the top couple of graphs there. And count the number of times a news organization with a good lawyer, and shout out to David McCraw, who's here as well. Oh yeah, David, I forgot you've become a star these days. All right. But point to me the number of news organizations with a good lawyer who's going to let you use the word fraud.
Right.
If law enforcement has not yet already used it. And so I think that's an example of,
right.
you know, it is okay to draw a conclusion. But I also think it's really important to remember that there's a difference. The internet is overflowing with opinionated people, and it's overflowing with opinions, many of them great, many of them terrible. You know, pick your side on which are which. But and people have been opinionating that, mm-hmm. you know, President Trump's finances, you know, were, you know, there's something shady there for a long time. But what actually caused multiple investigations to be opened?
Mm-hmm.
It's digging. It's reporting.
Right.
And that's the part of the journalistic ecosystem that has been weakened the most over the last couple of decades. And that's what I mean when I say
what about the impact of those stories? Because that was an astonishing display of journalism. Astonishing.
Yeah.
It was amazing. But whoosh, it went by, right? Like, that thing would have gone on for months before. It went by, and something with Stormy Daniels, and then Michael Avenatti was around, and then I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
Something else. Like, it just goes one after.
Well, and it was Kavanaugh.
Kavanaugh
as
oh, yeah,
well.
Yeah. Forgot about.
Yeah,
him.
We forgot
that. Was 2 weeks
yeah.
ago, right?
Look, I mean, the attention span thing is real, and I don't think we've fully grappled with how to deal with that. If you have suggestions, I'm all ears. I also do think that you know, that piece was read. You know, one of the longest pieces we ever produced was read by millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And caused city, state, and federal officials all to say that they were looking into opening an investigation. So I also don't totally buy that it didn't have an impact.
And it's not yet done.
Yeah.
It's not yet done.
We're going to take a quick break now from a word from our sponsors. We'll be back after this with A.G. Sulzberger, the publisher of the very much not failing New York Times.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries, not including...
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a 2-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
So let's talk a little bit about where you're going in terms of your business. Let's talk first about social media. I made a reference that Mark Zuckerberg ruined democracy. How do you look at social media now? Because they have sort of hollowed out media. They've hollowed out local media. They've put havoc all over the place. They allow, you know, fake news, the real fake news to go around, fake bots, fake opinions, lack of transparency. How are you looking as a business, as one of the most prominent publishing businesses?
Yeah, I mean, there's two sides to this. I mean, one is we have to be clear-eyed that these are the most powerful information monopolies in the history of the world, right? So specifically Facebook and Google, probably in that order. And
Twitter is just bothersome over here. And it's a little cesspool.
Well, Twitter's
over
just
here.
Ruining all our days.
Yes, I noticed you've done, he has done two tweets.
Oh God, it's so embarrassing. Did you read them?
Yeah, it was 2010. Like,
yeah, I was ordered to go onto Twitter by the national editor.
The fact that you just said I was ordered to go on Twitter.
Yeah, I know.
It's not the Twitter.
Did I say the Twitter?
Yeah, you
did. I know it's not the Twitter. That was just like a stutter.
All yeah. Right. Okay. On the Twitter, to the Twitters, the tweets from 2010 is pathetic. It's just pressing.
Oh, and they were both.
I tweeted twice from the bathroom. I mean.
I know. Well, they were done on consecutive days.
They were
the beginning
super dull.
They were my first two days.
Yes, and they're super dull
and,
tweets.
And then I think every media critic in America immediately started following me, and I was like, holy shit, this is a high wire act. I'm gonna get out of here. Which I know is a sign of weakness in your world.
Yeah, you do.
What were you?
I'm not even gonna ask you about Instagram or Tinder. But talk about their impact. But you need to use social media more, just in general. That's my advice to you. But how do you look at them? Because how do you deal with them? Are they as important to your business going forward?
Yeah. No, so these are the two most, you know, powerful information monopolies in the history of the world, and they are where a huge percentage of the global population go to get their news. And we need to own that. That is, we cannot pretend. If we want to introduce our work to a new generation, we cannot pretend that we can just ignore these spaces. So we know we have to be engaging with, you know, Facebook, with Google, with Twitter, with Snapchat, some of these other places. But we also know, because there's a pretty clear track record right now, that these are not journalistic institutions and they do not share our values. And quite frankly, you know, and I'm sure there's a bunch of people in this room who have sort of bet that, like, we crack the code. They do not care if you succeed or fail. And they both do not succeed if you succeed or fail affirmatively.
Right.
But also, they're comfortable just accidentally stomping you to death,
right.
You know, with an algorithm change. And so I think, you know, getting to that sort of sweet spot of what is clear-eyed engagement, where we understand that these are platforms that are not journalistic platforms, they don't particularly care about journalism, but they are a place where journalism is found and consumed, and you can introduce yourself to quality journalism.
Do you think they're media companies?
Everyone means something sort of different by that. What do you mean by that?
Do you think they're media companies? Should they have? They have immunity that you do not have. You cannot get it wrong. They have an actual law that they get immunity for what all that crap that's on their platform. Which is precisely why all that crap is on their platform.
Yeah, I mean, I look back at, like, and, you know, anyone who is working in a newspaper, you know, has to recognize that it wasn't, you know, it's only a matter of decades since, you know, we had this ad monopoly, right? And, you know, the reason we were able to pour money into quality journalism is because we had an ad monopoly, we had a distribution monopoly in the communities we covered. What's striking right now is there are two new companies with that ad monopoly, and they have it, you know, more profoundly than ever before. But where we would, you know, personally vet every single ad and make sure it met our standards, and we had, you know, I mean, you know, 60-page standards books with all these different obscure rules about, you know, like diet pills can't be advertised.
Right.
And we felt that that was part of our obligation, part of the social responsibility that comes with that role in the community.
It's because you're adults that took a humanities course in college, and these are people that did not. So, I mean, but...
You said that, not me, yeah.
Yeah, I say it again. They shouldn't be running these companies. So what do you do about, what do you do with them? How do we work with them?
Yeah. I mean, look, we've actually got pretty good partnerships. You know, particularly Google, we've got a decent partnership where, you know, they come to us, we come to them, you know, figure out how to work together on specific issues. And those relationships are good. I mean, you know this, like, you know, it's not that these folks set out to destroy journalism, right? You know, and if you're coming just, you know, in a clear-eyed way of what you want to accomplish and clear-eyed that your journalism needs to have its own center of gravity and you can't bet the farm on these platforms, then I think you can work with them.
So,
what else are we doing? We're also reporting the hell out of these stories.
Yes, nice Google piece today. Well done,
yeah.
I have to say. You all should read
thanks.
It. They're very naughty. Essentially, let me translate it for you. They're very naughty at Google, and it's bad. It's real bad over at Google. It's a fantastic story. So then how do you get big then? I want to finish up talking about this idea of how do you get big then? If you are sort of, you're pretty small. You're a pretty small organization, you know, the New York Times. How do you think you think big enough? Because sometimes I feel like the media organizations, and I think I said it to one of your editors when I was talking about, is think small and then think smaller. How do you get bigger? How do you imagine with these things, these giant semis running down the highway, running all the owning the digital advertising pretty much, not going to be broken up at this point at least. How does the New York Times think big enough about its brand, and how do you get there?
I mean, I'll take any advice you have to offer. I mean, I think a few things. One, we stopped holding the future at arm's length. And under Dean and his team, it feels like we've finally understood that, you know, we are going to need to succeed as a digital news company. And that's going to look different. It's not going to change who we are. You know, we are still an organization that's fundamentally built around original, on-the-ground, reported, expert, obsessively verified, independent journalism. That's the core. That doesn't change.
Right.
But what form that journalism takes, you know, right now, more people are listening to The Daily every day, mm-hmm. you know, which is our news podcast, than ever opened up the front page of the New York Times. So, you know, I think one answer to that is we're trying to embrace change as an organization.
What does that mean to you? I mean, people say I'm embracing change, and I have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So what does that mean from your perspective?
I mean, it means a lot of things. It means understanding that, that among other things, that print is our mature business, and it matters, and it's providing a ton of revenue that we need to support our big ambitious journalism, but it's also something that's going to shrink every year, and we are going to need to replace it with a thriving digital business. And so, you know, it's, you know, embracing change means figuring out what the digital incarnation of cooking, mm-hmm. you know, our food section is, and it turns out it's an app of recipes. You know, it means figuring out like what the daily front page experience, you know, looks like in a digital environment. It turns out it's something like The Daily. You know, it means experimenting, you know, making the report much more visual. It means integrating, you know, serious technical chops into our newsroom in a really profound way that allows us to do an investigation into Twitter, you know, that can systematically expose, you know, the widespread bot fraud that had been hiding under the surface.
Yeah, they're all over. Recently, Maggie Haberman was responding to a bot, and I had to text her and say, stop talking to the bots. You're talking to a bot. Like, she didn't even realize it. You're right. That's a good investigation to do.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
I actually lost my train of thought.
All right. What do you... AG, what is going to save the New York Times in the future? That's a pretty important question. That was the question. What is? What else?
So what's going to? I mean, well, you're asking about growth, and
right.
you know,
where
I
you
think
get that. How do you?
I think
get
we have a. So where do you get that? I think that the internet had this like this sort of myth of infiniteness, mm-hmm. right? That tricked a lot of us, mm-hmm. and that caused a lot of us to obsess over more. So there's like more content, and the word content actually to me, well, it suggests this very specific thing, right? It's like it's content is something that fills a content bucket, right? And you know, journalism, right? Or if you're in a different industry like television or whatever. You know, is like this requires an affirmative vision, right? We believe that people are, you know, in an on-demand environment, which the internet is,
right?
And now radio is, and now television is. In an on-demand environment, people will gravitate towards the best stuff,
right?
And so our business strategy today is like boiled down to make stuff that's worth paying for. Mm-hmm. And it's that simple. Make yep. stuff that's worth paying for. And, you know, the growth question's interesting. You know, it's we're like 6 or 7 years out from everyone making fun of us for believing that people will pay for journalism. Mm-hmm. And now I suspect most of the news organizations in this room either have a paywall yep. or are looking at one. And I don't think we fully know what the growth potential is because I think that the market hasn't fully developed.
We're going to take another break now, and we'll be back with A.G. Sulzberger, the publisher of The New York Times, after this.
This week on The Pitch, would you like fries with that?
People are what make franchises run. The person mm-hmm. who knows the business inside and out. Yep. Not someone who came off Wall Street because their check clears. Franchairs is the first investment marketplace where people can invest in franchises.
So you said $800 billion is what this market is a year. And hundreds of businesses are actually franchised businesses.
Thousands.
Thousands and thousands.
There are more brands franchised than there are stocks on the NASDAQ.
Oh.
You're raising a $4 million price round.
And what are the terms on that?
The $19 million post-money valuation.
And do you not think that the valuation is a little frothy?
This week, things get frothy when Kenny Rose brings a new alternative investment class to retail investors. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch, wherever you listen to podcasts.
There's a paper in Washington that a billionaire bought for not much money, actually. It was kind of a bargain for him.
Yeah.
Jeff Bezos is $164 billion,
yep.
right? Which is a lot of money. Would you ever see the need to have that kind of investment from one of these massive billionaires? Like, what would happen if, say, the one I think should buy you is Lorraine Jobs, but that's my, I bugged her about it.
The New York Times is not for sale.
I get that, but what would you, I get that. Okay, but here's, let me just say, what would you do, it's not for sale, because you're thinking in a different term, what would you do with $1 billion? What would the New York Times do if they had $1 billion to deploy?
Hear me out. It's an interesting question in the abstract, but when you actually look at the reality on the ground, Jeff Bezos has been very clear that he wants the Washington Post to make a profit. So, yes, the richest man,
right.
Not just on Earth, but I believe in the history of Earth, bought this newspaper.
Well, he's leaving Earth, but go ahead. Him and Elon are going off to Mars.
Bought this news.
They work out a lot. They do. Go ahead. Sorry.
So he bought this newspaper, and yes, he started investing in it again.
Right.
And all of us at the New York Times are delighted to see that because, quite frankly, we need more journalists in this country.
Right.
And it is not a zero-sum game. And we need a healthy Washington Post in this country. And so we are delighted to see it growing again. But the Washington Post is still a significantly smaller paper than the New York Times. And, you know, another paper owned by a billionaire, the Wall Street Journal, another very fine paper owned by a billionaire.
Mm-hmm. Not such a fine billionaire, but go ahead. Wall Street Journal people, I work there, go ahead.
is also smaller. So, I mean, I do not think that the ownership structure of the New York Times is somehow hindering our ability to invest in great journalism. The last year, we've expanded our Washington bureau, we've expanded our tech coverage, we've expanded our business coverage.
But, you know, startups get mass events.
Yep.
The other day, a dog walking firm got $1 billion. It was insane. Why would you not want that investment to do great local journalism? I could think of a million things I could do with $1 billion.
Yeah. Point to me where someone has just thrown a ton of money at the journalism problem, just thrown a ton of money, and it's worked out well. You know, I've seen some really great, honorable intentions from folks who I will not name here, but, you know, I...
Talking about Fusion, right?
I think...
Got it. There.
But I think what we need to do is we need to build a business that sustains journalism. We cannot just be reliant on the altruism of people. We don't want a government-run news organization like we see in other. The thing that makes the New York Times special, the thing that I think distinguishes us, you know, from almost any other news organization. But among a handful of news organizations, is its independence, and that is baked into every fiber of what this institution mm-hmm. is. And I don't think it's separate right. from...
I do think the New York Times with $1 billion is different than other organizations, because you all will use it correctly.
Well, then we're just going to go, and we're going to have to go out.
You just refuse to take the money I'm offering.
We're going to have to make that right. $1 billion ourselves.
And can you?
What's that? Can we grow that big? I'm really optimistic. You know, we've got 3.5 million, subscribers now, which is more than any newspaper at the peak of print. And I feel like we're still growing. I feel like we're still learning how to succeed in this digital space. And I feel like the market for paid journalism is still growing and maturing as well. So I'm optimistic. I really believe it when I say that. I don't think people are dumb. I think people want stuff worth paying for. I think they want the best journalism. I think, and it's part of the reason why I always answer the opposition question the way I do. You know, it's so easy to get drawn into cycles, but trust is a long game. And what we do, our mission: seek the truth, hold power to account, help people understand the world. That's perfect for this moment, but it's also perfect for every moment. And I believe that when the noise, clears and the smoke clears, and we all look around, we're gonna be hungry for news sources that you can trust.
Right. All right, last question. What is the thing you've done that's just most boneheaded of all this year?
That I've done personally?
As you know, now you're the CEO, you got the job title, you got the suit going on.
Well, our CEO is actually here.
And the CEO, I'm sorry, the publisher.
I'm not making any moves, Mark, don't worry.
I'm sorry, Mark, I don't mean CEO, the publisher. I know all your boneheaded moves, but go ahead. I'm teasing, he's fair. I love his Facebook stuff. What have you done? What do you think you've done well, and one thing you've done that you were like, I gotta...
I don't know. I mean, I've actually enjoyed this, but it felt pretty boneheaded not to ask who the moderator of this talk was gonna be.
Okay. Well done. Well played, young man. All right. A real one.
A real one. I thought I got out of that.
No.
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean,
What do you need to learn? Then I'll give it to you.
So much. I'm 38 years old, and I'm stepping into a big role at a critical moment. I remember, the announcement about my appointment had gone out, I think 10 days before the election or something like that. And, we had drawn up the front page, Madam President.
Oh.
And
then the meter was going off and on. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what, why don't we just blame the needle on me? Should we do that for the bonehead?
The needle, it was such a mind fuck, but go ahead.
Yeah. But I just remember, this moment, at the end of the night or the next morning, of just saying like, oh wow, this is a real moment. I went into this job sort of thinking like, all we have to do, as a company, as a leadership team, me in this role is find a sustainable business model to save quality journalism. And now we also have to defend the underlying precept of a free press in a functioning democracy. So
awesome.
I feel like I have a ton to learn. I feel like I'm learning a lot every day. And I'm sure if you get a couple drinks in these guys, every one of them will have some boneheaded thing.
Yeah, they don't need drinks to do that. Journalism people just vomit up information all the time.
Yeah.
So you think, if you looked at the New York Times 10 years from now, you're 10 years in the job.
Yeah.
What does it look like?
I mean, I hope it feels exactly the same, right? I hope that sort of sense of what it stands for and what you expect when you interact. But I hope we've got a big TV show that people tune into once a week, which we're launching, at the beginning of next year, that people have learned is dives into, something deeply in a sophisticated way that makes them pay attention to something that they didn't think they had to pay attention to, whether it's, genocide in Myanmar, or the, starvation the systematic starvation of children in Yemen. I hope that we have realized that quality journalism is what we do, and that it can take a million forms. And I hope we've proven that it has a big global audience. And I hope that we have proven that to enough of a degree that we have lessons that we can push back into the industry, because I really do believe that journalism is an ecosystem that needs to rise collectively. I don't think there's one institution, no matter how much you grow, that's going to grow big enough to support the needs of our society.
Right. Well, on that note, AG.
Thanks again to A.G. Sulzberger for joining me on stage and putting up with all my flack, and to the Knight Bajot Fellowship Program at Columbia University, where I went to journalism school, by the way, for letting us share the audio on this podcast. You can blame them for me. Thank you for all your listening. You can find more episodes of Recode Decode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And please tell a friend about this show. Now that you're done with this, go check out our other podcasts, Recode Media and Pivot. You can find those shows wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening to this episode of Recode Decode. And thanks to our editor, Joel Robbie, and our producer, Eric Johnson. I'll be back here on Wednesday. Tune in then.